Welcome, listeners, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about, you guessed it, board games. I'm here with my good friend Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am good, too, because I get to sit here and talk about board games with a good friend, which is one of the...
Oh, are you inviting someone else?
Which is one of my favorite things to do.
Is someone...
They'll be by later. Don't worry about it.
Is the Wendigo coming? Is that...
So first, we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then we're going to talk about some games we played this week, then some news and why it doesn't matter, and then our topic of the week, which is people expect too much from Kickstarters.
Yes, expectations in crowdfunding.
Mark, what did we review exactly 1 year ago?
Mille Fiori from Rainer Knizia. This is originally published in Europe in Schmidt Spiel. It took a while to get to North American distribution.
And follow-up, do we still have it?
No.
Unfortunate, because there is an expansion.
There is an expansion.
Which I haven't tried yet, and I'm kind of curious.
I haven't tried it either, but here's the thing with Rainer Knizia. I seldom enjoy the expansions that he designs. There's some exceptions. I think that the expansions to the Lord of the Rings games were genuinely interesting. The, you know, the way Friends and Foes mixes it up, even the Sauron expansion for Lord of the Rings is pretty cool. That having been said, I don't have a tremendous enthusiasm for the games, largely based on the IP. But other than that, if you look at, say, the Witchstone expansion, if you look at, based on my look at the remit of the Mille Fiori expansion, generally speaking, one of the things that characterizes Rainer Knizia's qualities as a designer is he makes these very, very tight, well-designed systems that cohere to an exceptional degree. And often, this involves an elegance and parsimony in the rule set. Not necessarily. He does some heavier stuff, like Tigers and Euphrates, although by the comparison of more contemporary Euros, is remarkably sparse in terms of rules. Overall, it has some rough edges and it's not the tightest rule set in the world, despite the fact that it is the greatest game ever made. Mille Fiori, very much like Witchstone to a certain extent, was kind of simple, but only in the sense of, look, here are all these zones. They all score differently. Go to town. And I didn't really do it for me, honestly. It's nice. I'd play it again, I guess, but I certainly didn't weep silent, bitter, unexpiated tears when a patron requested it and we sent it off.
There is talk that Rainer Knizia does not play other board games.
That's the rumor that he spreads, yes.
Mille Fiori feels like he played a roll and write, and he said, hold up, hold my eraser.
Well, no, but here's the thing, though. He kind of invented roll and write games. He was doing these web-published, dice-based games in the early 90s, for crying out loud.
Or maybe it was the newest uproar of, hey, we like combos. You like combos? Well, let me show you how combos work.
Yes.
Because, oh my God,
yes,
your turn can take quite a while in Mille Fiori if you get the right combination going.
That is absolutely true. I'll be talking more about combos later in the context of games we played this week.
So that's the game we reviewed a year ago, Mille Fiori by Rainer Knizia.
Gone, mostly forgotten, slight tinge of regret, but not really. Only in the sense that, oh, there's an expansion. I wonder if that made it better. Move on.
The pieces were interesting. Like, it was almost
were very nice.
It was almost like very delicate glass, even though they were plastic. It was that very hard, plasticky, clear.
Those pieces were great. The board and the cards, though, were not particularly inspired. No. So now we move to the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, you and I got to play Lunar Rush again. This is designed by Steven Skippy Brown and published by Dead Alive Games. And I'm not going to steal your thunder, but I always enjoy Lunar Rush. You are creating stuff on the moon by shipping up resources, because apparently only these things can be made on the moon because, you know, the moon.
Moon.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
And so you ship stuff up, and I love the fact that it's free. You don't have to pay for the resources. You only have to have enough room to ship them, and it has this interesting initiative system where you're bidding on the ships because some go up fast and only can carry very little things, or some go up very slow but can carry a lot. And so you got to sort of plan ahead and decide what you're going to do, because bidding costs victory points. And then you're upgrading all of your different worker placement modules up on the moon. You're creating these high things. And then you bring stuff back to the moon, and then you have to sell it.
Yes, this is Walker is now dramatically gesturing towards me. So there are three components, I think, to Lunar Rush. There's basically everything related to how the boats work. the bidding, the time considerations, the victory point considerations, what to stuff your boats with, your throughput considerations of what you need now and what you can afford to wait for, your prioritization of do I want one boat going up and one boat going down, or do I desperately want two boats going up or two boats going down this round? All of that, I think, is wonderful. Genuinely great. And then there are two other aspects, one of which I think is largely perfunctory and one of which rubs me the wrong way. The largely perfunctory bit is everything to do with your base management. So you've got what you do with these resources that you ship up to your moon. It's just largely a function of upgrades where, largely speaking, everything's worth around 5-ish points. You plug it in, you do the thing. Oh, it generated 2 of something. Now it generates 3 of something. All right, fine, whatever. And it doesn't strike me as particularly loaded with personality, tense trade-offs, difficulty. The difficulty is getting the stuff there. Everything about getting the stuff there is great. Once it gets there and everything after, I'm much less engaged by. The stuff that kind of rubs me the wrong way is the market system. The market system just doesn't seem to have enough teeth. There's not enough dynamism in the market. It's the value of goods starts out very high and just gradually goes down. It's not really built in such a way that I've perceived the ability of anyone to genuinely manipulate the market in an interesting way. It's just sell it as fast as you can. That's it. The longer you wait, odds are excellent that the value is going to go down. There's not really the kind of push and pull from a genuine supply and demand mechanism.
Yeah, the argument might be a bit that there's all sorts of different markets you can use, but I still don't think that that really changes enough to make a difference. I feel as though this has always been a bugbear for me as well. I love how the whole game plays, but then how it, like, the wind up with the market just doesn't seem to, fit into the game as well as everything else does.
Yes. Largely speaking, it is about it's a resource manipulation cube pusher where you're shoving in cubes and points come out the other end. Getting the cubes is cool. Everything thereafter, no, not so much. And frankly, this is an example, just for what it's worth, where an expansion might do wonders. You know, better modules, more interesting base upgrades, different economy boards where there's actually some market manipulation going on. That I could easily imagine being in a position where I'd really appreciate it. But frankly, I generally don't like cube pushers at my stage in hobbyist gaming to begin with. The ones that I like do different stuff to mix with the formula, like, for example, Sidereal Confluence. The actual cube pushing in Sidereal Confluence, the changing cubes into other cubes, is roughly as boring as the changing cubes into other things in Lunar Rush. The difference is that all the architecture surrounding it in Sidereal Confluence is so much more satisfying. So I'm still willing to play Lunar Rush by virtue of the quality of everything surrounding the ships. It's really interesting, well done, and novel. And frankly, the rest of the stuff I just largely suffer through. We actually had like a 5-minute conversation after a game of Lunar Rush talking about the gold modules. Because first time I played Lunar Rush, no gold modules were touched. This time, a lot of gold modules were built. And we had a substantive discussion about whether or not they actually changed the economy of the game in an interesting way. And the consensus was no. It was just another opportunity to shove in a couple cubes and get 5 points at the end of the game out of it. The margin calls weren't interesting. And that is the biggest criticism I have of Lunar Rush.
Well, next time we'll put the moon wonders back in, and maybe that will mix things up a little bit more.
Maybe.
We have 2 copies that were given to us, one normal and one deluxe copy. And like Mark said, there's an expansion coming out very soon that will add specific faction powers and more stuff. So looking forward to that.
And this is a review copy we got from the designer. I got to play Dragons Down. I have some thoughts. Dragons Down is by Mr. B Games, designed by Scott Damaris.
Is there like a bunch of adventurers on the dragon and it's flying over like the sort of enemy zone and it crashes and then they fight around the dragon and try to get out of there?
Some Somalians show up for no earthly reason? And
yes.
No. Oh. I do not know why it's called Dragons Down.
Okay.
I suspect it's some kind of down, maybe some sort of noun for a place name that animals roost. I don't know. I will confess my ignorance here. Scott Damaris is the designer of Hellenica, which was also published by Mr. B Games, which was a Civ-ish game taking place in Greece, as you might imagine. And we played that a couple times, and it was okay. It was promising. I'd be willing to play it again. I haven't played with the expansion. Dragons Down is an attempt to modernize Magic Realm, which is an interesting task. For one thing, I'm surprised that it got the uptake that it did, because Magic Realm has always been a super niche, super impenetrable, inaccessible in many different kinds of ways product. Famously, it's had 4 different rule sets. I would argue that the second rule set was the best. I'm in the minority there. Most people prefer the 3rd version of the rule set with some combination of reference to the 4th. The second edition rule set is in excess of 70 pages, and it is one of the shorter versions available. And it's got a lot of really interesting stuff in Magic Realm. I think it is one of those projects that's worth figuring out how to understand, largely as an intellectual exercise. You can play it solo every once in a while, as I do, and it's genuinely interesting. And Dragons Down attempts to modernize it. It is very, very obvious in terms of its inspiration. The hexes in particular look almost identical. It's a hex-based fantasy adventure game, so basically it's effectively Mage Knight. And the action system is also extremely reminiscent of Magic Realm, the exception being that in Magic Realm, you had an entirely unthematic pre-programming element. You would wake up at the dawn of the day and say, here's what I'm going to do for the rest of the day, and you just plot it out and you couldn't make any alterations to that. Dragon's Down's more flexible. When it's your turn, you just decide what to do with your four actions. And indeed, much of what Dragon's Down has done is to make the game easier to learn, easier to play, less deadly. For the most part, I think those are salutary goals. The problem is, and this is the chief difficulty I have with Dragon's Down, is that while it preserves a lot of the cool combat puzzle element of Magic Realm, how fast am I attacking? How fast am I dodging? Am I going to be able to avoid this attack, but attack fast enough to be able to damage this thing before it dodges out of the way? And if I don't dodge, will I be able to tank the damage by virtue of the armor that I've got and the things available to wound? All of that is fundamentally preserved in Dragon's Down. But whereas Magic Realm, in my experience, erred way too far under to the scale of looking at the map and saying, I can kill none of these things except for this thing sometimes. Okay, can I get there without dying? Oh no? Oh well. Dragon's Den goes the other extreme. So turn one, my colleague was ambushed by a couple griffins, and I immediately sort of tensed up, sort of like, oh, well, this is...
here we go.
Here we go. And it's like, oh, you can kill them both without suffering any damage. Okay, that happened. All right. And about midway through the game, about 10 turns into a 30-turn game, we were invincible killing machines. It was just a race to see how much of the countryside we could lay waste to in terms of the competition. And I'm not saying that you need to be as deadly as Magic Realm. Magic Realm was infamous for, like, you can be heavily armored. Even you found a couple of treasures, you're armed to the teeth, you've even got a whole bunch of friends at your back, a whole bunch of mercenaries. That's one aspect that has been cut entirely. I understand why. It added significant complexity to the game. I admit it loses a lot of the flavor when you can't go and hire natives, but... And then you can get murdered by some bats. Giant bats? No, just bats.
Just normal bats.
just a bunch of bats. Because the fundamental dynamics of both Magic Realm and Dragon's Down that hasn't changed is there's just one of you. You can only do one attack around. So if you're fighting six things, ooh, they will get to you. Ultimately, I think a lot of the design choices here are fascinating. And ultimately, I think they preserved a lot of the good stuff for Magic Realm. But frankly, the challenge was just so low. I don't know if this is just a problem because I'm experienced with Magic Realm, but the person I played with who had not played Magic Realm did find it disappointingly trivial a lot of the time. You know, the first couple combats, you're puzzling things out, figuring out how you're able to attack sooner or dodge effectively or this, that, and the other. But after a certain point, it's like, oh yeah, I can kill all these things, no problem. Oh, two giants and a tremendous ancient dragon? Pfft, no worries. And I found that very disappointing.
Sounds a little bit like Mage Knight, right? You know, first turn, you're figuring out your deck, and then by the end, you're just walking through everything that comes in front of you.
Yeah, although later turns in Mage Knight, the difference is you still have to puzzle out how you're going to get there. You have to maximally use the abilities of your followers, the effects of your hands to eke out that last bit of combat potential or block or whatever. In the context of Dragon's Down, your third combat is going to be an awful lot like your first, which is going to in turn be an awful lot like your seventh because of just the parameters involved. It's like, okay, well, I need to do this much damage, sock away those cubes. Okay, well, the rest is up for speed. What do I need to do with speed? Oh, it's the same combination I used against the last guys. Off to the races.
Gotcha.
So keep in mind, this was only the first scenario. It is a smaller map and doesn't have a lot of the variability or some of the other variables of other ones. The way things work in Dragon's Down, which also facilitates setup considerably, Magic Realm had a tremendously complicated setup procedure, is you pick a certain number of terrain packs, and that gives you a tray full of monsters and a certain set of chits that you mix together and a certain set of terrain tiles that you mix together. Much, much, much easier, more straightforward, and leads to a modularity that Magic Realm never had. Magic Realm, you do a variable map setup, but at the end of the day, you're still playing with the same map tiles. That much I appreciate, but honestly, I don't see adding more map sets, terrain sets, adding a greater variety of beasties to up the challenge considerably, because it just increases the variety, not necessarily the depth of challenge involved. That having been said, I'm sufficiently intrigued by a lot of the design choices and watching a system iterate that I'm inclined to try again, despite the fact that this is easily a 3 to 4 hour game. So what I'll probably do is, if I don't have anyone else that's interested in going through the paces again, I might do a solo game of quote-unquote the full version. There's even a scenario that replicates Magic Realm's very, very strange scoring system, where at the start of the game you decide whether you're going after fame, treasure, spells, or some combination of that, and those determine how many victory points you get from various things. And I was very gratified to see that. It's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, you really are a huge nerd about Magic Realm the way some of us are. So Dragon's Den was fascinating. I enjoyed it, but was ultimately disappointed by the challenge, and I'm going to try it again in hopes to come up with a deadlier realm. And that is my early experience with Dragon's Den.
Mark, you and I got to play Things in Rings, and I picked this up because I learned the concept, and I thought it was fantastic, and I was very interested in how it would play out in the different groups that I'm in. And so what you're doing in Rings and Things, you're making... In the full game, the advanced Things and Rings.
Well, it's not necessarily the full game. We're going to have to relitigate this game. In the advanced game, yes.
I am 100% in the wrong. I didn't even look at the rule book. Like I said, I did a little bit of, you know, in-depth before I bought it.
You were like the American Supreme Court. You were going on vibes.
Exactly. It's like, you make a Venn diagram with this string, and then you have topics for these. So that's what you do. You have three colored rings, yellow, blue, and red, and you make this Venn diagram with the circles so that everyone is connected, and they're all connected in the middle.
They all overlap, yeah.
They all overlap. And then you have easy, medium, and hard cards that you can decide what you want for each color. And then you have this gigantic deck of things.
So, oatmeal, volcanoes, churches, bridge, apple, statue, fireworks, sword.
And
as examples from our last
game. And they may or may not fit into one of these three categories. I'm not going to do all the categories.
Well, let's just give an example of our last game, right? The yellow category relates to the structure of the word, and it was, in this case, a very straightforward one, 5 letters or less. The red one, it's a huge bugbear. The red category we had was useful.
One word.
Useful. And then the blue was bigger than a person.
Yeah, so in red seems to be always, it seems to always have like some sort of context to it, or the player that's playing, the game master, the knower.
It has to make a series of tricky judgment calls, yeah.
Yeah, constantly. Because another one was, what was the one I had again?
It
was
easily found if lost.
Yeah, easily, yeah. So things like that. So, and if they apply to multiple ones, then they're going to go between. If they apply to all of them, they go in the middle. If they apply to none of them, then they go off to the side.
So fork, for example, I would say in the previous case, belongs in both yellow and red because it is useful, and fork is 5 or fewer letters. Volcano, I put exclusively in the blue category because it's more than 5 letters. Volcanoes are not strictly useful. I had to parse usefulness as like useful in human endeavor in a tool-y kind of utilitarian way. But it's bigger than a person, so it goes in blue. I had to decide that, you know, oatmeal was useful because it's mostly about sustenance, but pie wasn't because it's it was rough.
So it's odd. I find it was odd that the main game is competitive and the sub game is cooperative.
Because yeah.
I find as though the cooperative game would just be much more fun to try to sit and figure out, because the object of the game in the co-op is not to figure out exactly. Because only the knower knows what these cards are. Everyone else is trying to figure out where to place cards by seeing where the knower moves them to, and you try to suss out why they move them or what's the difference between the different areas. And so you're trying to get rid of your cards. You're not necessarily trying to know exactly what these things are.
But
you're
close enough.
Close enough that you can get rid of your cards. Because when you play a card and you put it in the right spot, you get to play another card. If you play it in the wrong spot, the knower will move it, and you have to draw another card. And so the knower gets a hand of 10 cards. They get to first place cards equal to the number of players, and then you just go around the table, and you're trying to get rid of all of your cards before the knower runs out of cards, because when it comes to the knower's turn, they get to play another card, hopefully to help you.
Thought of a walker cheat.
In quotation marks.
Does it say specifically in the rulebook that the knower is not allowed to play the card in the wrong place, say oops, and then draw a replacement?
Or does the knower have to play with their whole hand in the first turn because they're putting them all in the right place?
Good point.
Anyway, Things and Rings is fantastic. I really enjoy it. It plays exactly the way I want it to. It in the So Clover code names group, they loved it. A ton of fun. They all wanted to play as the knower, so we played it multiple times. That is on the stream for this week if you wanted to check it out. And then in the other group where people aren't so into those games.
Oh, that's not fair.
It didn't go as well. I don't think they hated it, but it just didn't hit as well as it did in the other group.
I have two things. First of all, it is vastly more fun for me to play as the knower than it is as the guesser. So the one running the show, I think, gets to make far more interesting decisions.
Yeah, that's part, true. But the chat between the players trying to figure out, I find way more interesting.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting to observe as the knower. But frankly, the confusion that I felt and the opacity of so many of the clues, it really rubs me the wrong way, which leads me to my second objection, which is, so far I have yet to see a red card that didn't strike me as hopelessly ambiguous in a way that would lead to a borderline degenerate play state. I'm not using these terms lightly. Whether it's a cooperative or a competitive game, in either case, it's very problematic to have basically the one running the game master, if you will, have to basically decide what the things actually mean. It's too freeform. It's an awkward combination. The yellow conditions, extremely straightforward, dare I say, have borderline objective validity. In the sense of determinism and necessity attached to them. But the blue ones require a little bit of judgment, but acceptable. So, for example, bigger than a person. I said statue wasn't bigger than a person, even though the picture included a plinth, because it's a representation of a person and the picture showed a person. By the way, the art on the things is great. I love the art on all the thing cards. But I put, then surfboard came up, and yeah, it's taller than a person, wider than a person a lot, but, you know, it doesn't have a whole lot of mass to it in comparison. So I said it was not bigger than a person. Okay, fine. Those decisions I'm all right with. You know, there's a certain amount of subjectivity inherent in all these games. That's okay. The red ones, though, so like easily found if lost. Apple. Maybe? Bridge.
How do you lose a bridge?
Can you lose a bridge? And if you do lose a bridge, if you've lost the bridge, can you find it? Yeah, maybe trivially, or maybe it's impossible because you've lost the bridge.
It's on the map, though. I'm sure it's there still.
I don't know. Like, it's not that I don't know, and it's not that it's unclear. It's just the person making the judgments about what these categories mean is also the person who basically gets to decide whether or not the group wins the game or they win the game.
It's true.
So that is just an awkward setup. I would happily play again as the knower. I'd be willing to try again with maybe a curated red stack. I'd want to sit down with the red cards and see if there are any ones that didn't strike me as very problematic.
Yeah, that's what I'm so hesitant to look through those decks, because whereas the thing deck is giant, and I don't know if I'll ever see it,
right,
the other decks are small, and I'd really worry about memorizing and being reminded of, it's like, oh,
I hear you.
I remember that yellow card, it must be this one, and I would hate that. But I am interested to see if the red ones change a little depending on the difficulty, and if they became a little more clear if you make them harder, which would be odd and interesting all at the same time.
So what I would endorse is a kind of Walker remix of the red cards, empowering the knower to engage in kind of a remix and decide before any cards are played, before they even look at their own object cards, just when they have the category cards, to make a clarification in their own mind, a stipulation, maybe even have them write it down about what red means. And so they can operate on that basis rather than having to define it by ostension as things evolve. I realize 9 times out of 10 I'm in favor of defining things by ostension, but every once in a while there's an exception. So, for example, again, returning to our previous play, useful. I could have rewritten that as tool.
It's true.
Right? And then that would have been, I wouldn't have had to parse like what kind of foods are useful and what kind of foods aren't useful. Because, again, anything is useful in the right context. By the way, listen to the second episode about philosophy, in which I talk about hypothetical imperatives in the context of Kantian moral philosophy. And in this, in another context, in the wrong context, nothing is useful. So anyway, it was driving me crazy. Similarly, you could have decided, any number of decisions would have been fine. Easily lost to found, you could have defined it as losable objects, or, I don't know, things that tend to get lost frequently, or any one of, just yeah. Make a decision rather than this weird sort of, I don't know, because both times when we played, someone would play a card, the knower would once again look at the red card like a monkey doing a math problem and be like, I guess not.
In one of the games we had the knower had to look up on the internet about a bunch of things because the card was, it floats.
Oh my goodness.
So what floats?
I don't know what floats.
Exactly.
Churches, very small rocks.
They were immediately on their phone almost every time.
I don't know, buoyancy.
Yes, keyboards do float.
Keyboards float?
Apparently keyboards float.
Okay.
Who knew?
Huh.
So that's Things and Rings, designed by Peter C. Hayward.
Keyboards float.
And published by Allplay. I will play it anytime. I love it.
Yeah, for me it's provisional. My frustration level can only go so far.
The other game we streamed, which was the mainstream, was the new game designed, not the new game previously designed by Reiner Knizia, because it is a reprint of Beowulf the Legend. This is called Ego.
Extraterrestrial Greeting Organization.
And this is
a preview copy we've received from the publisher, Bitewing Games.
And it's currently on crowdfunding. And it was very much enjoyed by everyone that played. We even streamed Beowulf the Legend before. They claim they enjoyed this more.
Oh, really?
They enjoyed it's much more colorful. They felt it was interesting the way you could manipulate the map, and the map would be slightly different every time you played. Not only the position of the different boards, but different boards come into play. We played with all of the expansions that you could.
Yeah, the modules. Because we played it, the time that we played it, we played it sort of the basic version, and one of my key complaints was there's not enough to do with money. And then I looked at the rule book and I realized, oh yeah, this is basically the basic version of Beowulf the Legend, the version I've never played, because the advanced version adds interesting things to do with money. And sure enough, Ego follows that same structure. So I'm very curious to try with that in particular.
Yeah, the money came out. Unfortunately, the yellow board was the board we didn't play with. So, and I think that's mostly the coin board, but I think it was the add on to the red board that made us spend a bunch of the money token. So it did come into play a little bit, but not as much. So what the two expansions are one are square boards that attach directly onto the random boards that you put out. So you have like purple and yellow and blue, and you have small boards for all of those. Then the rules state that you can use as many as you like. So I only used two. I didn't want the game to be too long.
Right.
And I like that because it's sort of gauges how long of a game you want to play. You want to play a longer game, then you have an extension board for all of them.
Yeah, the flexibility seems to have shot through the roof. Beowulf the Legend is a series of encounters in a fixed order, and it is invariant. I'm not going to say that it feels repetitive. I love Beowulf the Legend. It's one of my favorite games of all time. But it is very much the same that you're following a fixed path and all the encounters happen in the same order. In the context of Ego, not only is it the case that the order changes up, but the number of encounters you have is more or less up to you, from a minimum of around 15-ish all the way up to many, many more. And given that it's still not going to be overlong in any case, that gives you a lot of flexibility.
So in Beowulf Legend, there are scroll tokens that you're going to get. In this one, there are sort of alliance tokens. And with the second expansion that we played with, it adds different tokens in there, like drawing more cards or getting rid of the penalty tokens. And what it also does is add these circles that you put. This one, the rule book specifically stated that you must put one at the end of every sort of system that you go to. So you're definitely putting out four or five of these, but they're very quick. It's more like show you have something, get the benefit, move on.
Yeah, it's just an extra special kind of encounter where you don't spend the cards.
Just so.
Because for those of you who are unfamiliar, Beowulf the Legend is a press your luck game. It's kind of an auction / press your luck game where you stay in as long as you want to or as long as you can. When you bow out, you basically take the highest number available. So if you're playing a five-player game and you bow out first, you take the five. And then after once everyone's done, you claim the available benefits for that encounter in order. So there are good things, there are bad things, there are situationally good things. Sometimes you are relatively indifferent to where you are. Sometimes you desperately want to be in at least third. Sometimes you want to be first or bust. And so on top of that, there are all these lovely hand management considerations. And then there's the risking, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah, the risking, I like how they did the I like how they did the risking in this new game. It's sort of like a yellow triangle. If you see a yellow triangle somewhere, it means you're allowed to risk. So when you need to place a bid, instead you can say, I'm going to risk it. You're going to draw a number of cards based on what the risk is for that particular thing. And you have to match the symbols that people are playing for this auction.
Well, you don't have to. It's weird. So
true. You sort of want to, because if you get both the same, and there's always a penalty associated with it.
Yes.
As long as if you get a partial success, then you're going to take the penalty. If you totally miss both all of the symbols, then you don't get the penalty. If you get all of the symbols you need, then you also don't get the penalty. It's only when you hit one or two, but not all the cards, then you're going to take the penalty.
In Beowulf, the way that it worked was you take the risk, and if anything matched, you take all the cards, either in hand in some risk scenarios or played to your current bid in the context of other risking scenarios. If none of them matched, if you ended up busting, you then got a scratch. More on that in a second. And
and you're out of the auction.
Well, in the context of auctions. In the context of Ego, it's generally been flattened. It's a lot less luck-driven, which I understand completely why that was done. A lot of people play Beowulf and think that it's too dependent on luck. I think these people are flatly wrong, and that Beowulf is vastly more deterministic than people give it credit for, primarily because of the difference between scratches and wounds. Because in Beowulf, it wasn't the case that every subsequent wound or scratch you got goes into a pile. There were these sort of tiered stepping points. One scratch, no problem. Two scratches, you're a little worried because your third scratch gives you a wound. And the difference between no wounds and a wound, pretty big deal. And then again, the difference in one wound and two wound, not a huge deal. But your third wound, oh, look out. And so there were these situations where you could look and plan ahead and say, okay, here I can suffer to be a little battered up. Then I can heal up there. Okay, so this is the stretch where I need to be careful. Okay, now I'm playing with house money. I can fail these risks. I don't care. That's great. In Ego, it's a little flattened because you don't have that distinction between scratches and wounds. Instead, it's just a question of negative points. Yes, it's triangular scoring, so the more you have, the worse it is. Absolutely. And it's also the case that it's not really an all-or-nothing situation. And normally, I like that softening. But for some reason, in the context of Ego, again, I've only played the base game. I want to try the advanced game. I want to try without the other modules. It just felt like the risking decisions were less tense, less consequential. It's just a trade with the bank, it feels more like, with occasionally you get a lucky result where it's not a trade anymore. It's just sheer benefit. I preferred the way it worked in Beowulf based on my one play of Ego.
And also, like you said before, there was five suits in Beowulf the Legend, whereas now there are only four.
That's true.
So your chances of succeeding in the success are a little higher.
That is true as well, yeah. I do like how the different risk scenarios, though, operate on different parameters. Like, for example, in Beowulf, it was almost always risk two cards and the failure consequence was a scratch. In Ego, it could be one card, it could be two cards, it could be three cards, sometimes four. And if any of them match, you get the good thing and some penalty, which may be the scratch equivalent, but it may be something else entirely as well. And so that degree of variety also, again, much appreciated. So I feel like, again, having played one base game of Ego, it's not letting Ego play to its strengths because the advanced version brings it closer to Beowulf and the variability, the different setups can really let you change up how the game feels. But the overall approach to risk management is not to my liking on immediate blush, but more to follow.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we're going to talk about it in the news, about the crowdfunding project itself. So that's Ego.
Walker showed me the expansion to Keep the Heroes Out. This is Boss Battles by Luis Brue at Brue Games. And the way that this changes up is it takes the weapons-grade adorable game Keep the Heroes Out, which is a co-op game of playing as different monsters, keeping heroes away, and it introduces a kind of scenario-driven boss element where after defeating the boss, they now join the retinue of available things. So Walker's group had previously defeated the Rock Troll. Nobody played as the Rock Troll, which is fine. The Rock Troll is adorable, as they all are. And this time we were fighting the Gorgon. And once she was Gorgon, but now she'll be gone. Pause for laughter. Anyway, it sort of recasts the Gorgon as kind of a rock superstar with a whole bunch of adoring fans, even though she keeps petrifying them. That doesn't seem like a solid way to build a fan base. Maybe we've been doing it wrong.
It rocks, Mark. Do you see the pun there?
I see the pun, and my be gone isn't worth anything, but no. It rocks. Okay, yeah. Okay, now I understand what it is. And here's the thing about Keep the Heroes Out. I really enjoy the card play. Everyone's got their own deck for cards. You can buy new cards to add them in. You're managing an entire pool of monsters, and the number of monsters differs for different factions. You could have a large number, and you could play a card that gives you 3 movement points. You can move one of your monsters 2 spaces, another one 1 space. Same thing with attacks, getting everyone in position. That part's great. It's so cute. I love how it works. The different scenarios are neat. The variety of monsters are great. The AI, I find, I've commented every single time, I cannot internalize how the AI works, whatever. Hubie does it for me, that's fine. The other thing that I have a problem with, and this is during those moments when I could glimpse and see how the AI actually works, how the heroes operate, is it really feels like there's no good management of tension. Either everything is fine, or you're on the precipice of utter disaster. Because the way the heroes operate is they basically just keep going until they fail something. So in the early rounds, you've got effectively these walls. They're called chests, but they basically act like walls. You know, on the outside, they spawn into areas where you need 3 heroes at once in order to open a chest. First hero spawns, we don't care. Second hero spawns, oh, okay, someone go kill some of them. All right, I'm on it. Then eventually there's some sort of cascade where they bust that down, and then the next wall is 2. Now you're seriously in trouble, because now they can just start sweeping over. There's no gradual encroachment of awfulness. It's like how in pandemics sometimes you have those epidemic outbreaks where one epidemic causes another outbreak and another outbreak and another outbreak. Those are the exception in pandemic rather than the rule. There's a buildup of tension. I feel like in Keep the Heroes Out, that's all that happens in terms of actually threatening you, and that part is unfortunate. Still perfectly happy to play. It's reasonably quick, and as I keep emphasizing, the variety of monsters is great, and I love managing those. I just don't like how the difficulty works, and I don't like how the AI operates, insofar as I understand it.
Yeah, I love it. There's going to be another Kickstarter starting soon that's going to be focused on the digital implementation of Keep the Heroes Out, but he's already said that there are going to be physical things you can buy that will add to your game. I already saw the embers, the cute little fire guys. Can't wait.
As long as Luis Broa wants to illustrate meeples, I am willing to buy meeples from Luis Broa.
There's already a free demo on Steam, so if you wanted to check out the digital version, you can do that right now. And looking forward to the crowdfund. That is Keep the Heroes Out Boss Battles. Played Mexica with some of the listeners. It is an older game by Michael Kiestein and Wolfgang Kramer, sort of, you know, part of their Mask series, like with Tikal. And the newest version is by Yellow Games. And it plays, has the same feel. I don't want to say it plays the same, but it just has the same feel where you have a certain number of action points and you're desperately trying to do the best, eke the most out. And you're putting out these rivers to section off parts of the map. And they have to be a certain square count to reflect the counters that are available, because as soon as there's exactly that number, then you can take one of those tokens, score partial of the points, and now that's sort of like a scoring area. Every time a round ends, whoever has the most temples in that area will score the bigger amount of points, and so the whole map sort of, you know, puzzles out into all these different sections, and you're trying to move around and get your temples in there because there's limited space. Your actual pawn takes up space, and you can place bridges. It's a very interesting system about, because you can also teleport anywhere you want, but that takes 5 of your 6 points. Anyway, it's a very interesting sort of action point manipulation system.
So you've now played all 3 games of the original Mask trilogy, Mexico, Tikal, and Java. Torres is also included as an honorary member, despite the fact that it is not a Mask game, but same designers and still uses action points. Are you in a position to make any sort of overarching comment about the series?
Wow. I didn't realize Torres part.
It's an honorary member.
I think I'd go with Torres. I really enjoy all my plays of Torres.
Yeah, Torres is very popular. Yeah.
And it's so good. And after that, the recent games we played of Java, I thought were very interesting.
Java's cool. So as I recall, early days in the hobby and when the Mask trilogy was much more in common conversation, typically it was regarded that Mexica was the easiest of the three, the least complex, at least in terms of game rules, then Tikal, and then Java was the brain-burning one. And based on my experiences, that's definitely been true. I don't know how I'd rank them in terms of preference, but I will say I have not yet played Torres, and someday I plan on doing so. Yeah, Walker looks shocked and scandalized, viewers. He's clutching all his non-existent pearls.
Torres is this very, tons of these little tower pieces that you stack up. And
I've played games with those tower pieces. I've just never played Taurus.
And you create these giant castle, I guess you could say. And the king moves around, and certain castles are going to score. And you want to be the highest on the castles. And like Mark said, and you get to go enter in the like a bottom door. And you just pop out anywhere you want in one of the upper doors. It has this very interesting sort of move your pieces around, build more, stop people from a little bit like Santorini. You know what I mean? That type of blocking movement type game. Anyway, absolutely. Love Torres.
But that was Mexico.
That was Mexico.
Played it on Board Game Arena, I assume?
We did.
All right. Played a second game of Avatar The Last Airbender, Aang's Destiny. So this is the co-op deck builder by Patrick Marino and the OP Games. Credit to the OP Games for actually crediting their designers. A lot of companies like the OP don't. Mentioning no Hasbros in particular. And this is a redevelopment of the Harry Potter game. It has some rules differences about how the adversaries work, and there's some rules about bending and two different card markets and things of that nature. I haven't played the Harry Potter game, but the reputation definitely precedes it as being way too easy. And this is absolutely the case for Avatar The Last Airbender. The second scenario was, if anything, easier than the first. And that was a bigger problem because the way you win in Avatar The Last Airbender is you deplete both the mission deck and the adversary deck. And the mission deck is a little more interesting than the adversary deck in that it requires different requirements. So a little bit of combat, a little bit of currency, all currency, discard some cards, take a wound, do various things.
And on top of that, it seeds your decks and the offering with interesting new cards.
Absolutely. The adversaries, on the other hand, just hit you for various negative effects at the top of every round, and they only take combat damage. And we kind of took care of the missions very early, and then we were just at the point of just doing as much damage as possible. And that really narrows the horizon of what you want to do, because we spent the late game not buying many cards, because we only wanted to buy cards that generated combat, and not really caring about economy, and just, what do I do that does damage? And so it felt very mechanical for the last third or so of the game, which is not to its credit. It wasn't particularly long as far as games go. It's not like it was a 100-minute long slog. But when you're talking about a very, very simple deck builder, and you're talking about comparing it to all the Realms games, comparing it to Shards of Infinity, where it at least understands, okay, this is all going to be about combat from the get-go, I would much rather play something along those lines. Now, is it evocative of the animated series? A little bit.
Yeah, I really do enjoy it.
It does a reasonably good job of hitting touchdowns.
Yeah, like that one deck, it totally goes through the episodes. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that episode, and you have to do certain things that make sense there. And then the villains sort of follow that same sort of trail. Anyway.
And the way that it adds new stuff with every box is kind of interesting. We didn't really employ the new mechanical innovation in the second box. In the second box, you can basically allow non-benders to bend in certain circumstances. But, you know, the card supply didn't really facilitate that in any substantial way. I'm perfectly willing to go along if people suggest it. If I'm in the mood for something that's not going to be particularly taxing, either mentally or otherwise, it might even possibly be something I suggest. But only to people who, A, know what they're getting into, not a decision-rich game, and B, probably only with fans of the property. We played the first game with Josephus, who has not seen the cartoon, and he was mostly like, so what's the deal with this? It's like, oh, well, it's actually kind of an interesting story. And he's like, yeah, sounds great. Which is entirely reasonable. If I hadn't watched the cartoon, I'd probably react the same way to people telling me all about it. Like, once there's a King of Fighters or a Fatal Fury deck building game in the same way, I'll look forward to boring all you people with stories about how Geese did this, that, and the other to Billy Kane.
Can't wait.
Oh, yeah. Wait for it. So that's Avatar The Last Airbender, Aang's Destiny.
And speaking of games on BGA, also, Mark, I played a little bit of Formula Day. I won't go too much into it. It just all came down to the very last turn.
Oh, yeah.
I hate it.
Really?
See, I come out of a turn, Mark. And for me to cross the finish line, there is one person behind me. They are in the top blue gear, you see.
Yes.
They're going to go by that start line probably 85%. No problem. I'm coming out of the corner, unfortunately, in the purple gear.
That's not as good.
I'm only going to cross this finish line if I roll the highest 20.
Did you roll a 20?
I did not. You see, because the game works, because I'm, even though I'm in a lower gear, I'm ahead of them, so I will go first. So if I get across that finish line, then I win.
Uh-huh.
I did not roll 20. And then I got you know, two squares away from the finish line. And
you should
have
shifted up.
I saw this blur go by
me. You should have been in a higher gear.
I should have played better.
Wait, let me get this straight. So your complaint is that you lost a racing game because you weren't going as fast as the other player.
My complaint is injustice.
Oh, that's your complaint. Okay, I apologize.
Anyway, always love Formula Day. I have a couple games going on there, and I'm having fun playing all of them.
Walker, I'm broadly sympathetic to you, but I'm not sympathetic to claims of justice. I think that I don't really believe in rights talk, and I don't really believe in justice. And if you want any sense of justice or fairness, that's a cosmological question, not one that can be found in the material world. But anyway, moving on. Got to play Aquatica Coral Reefs. This is the second expansion to Aquatica, the first one being Cold Waters. And I was initially a little tepid, no pun intended, about getting the second expansion because I figured, oh, well, you know, Aquatica, whatever. But then Aquatica is just one of those games where it's hard to remember. Every time it gets to the table, everyone's like, oh, yeah, why don't we play this all the time? Aquatica is super fun. And one of the things that I love about Aquatica is that it manages to have all the combo-tastic turns of your heavier Euro games with all the satisfying interlocking bits of, ooh, I got to line this up with this other thing and do this thing, and now I get Bonanza. But the turns are snappy, the game is snappy overall, and so you're not just sitting there for 5 minutes while someone, possibly Sidewinder, is managing her spreadsheet so as to eke out an extra gear so they can get 2 points this turn instead of one. And honestly, that's the way I like to do it. You get to feel clever, you get to have all your toys coalesce into an interesting scenario, but at the same time not get bogged down with too much complexity or downtime. And specifically, what Coral Reefs introduced is the aforementioned Coral Reefs, which are just extra points here and there, a little bit of sprinkling, but mostly it's in the context of these new reef tiles that you acquire that gives new special abilities to all your columns of territories. So, for example, you might have one that say every time you slot in a territory in this column, it automatically gets seeded for free. And then you might have one in an adjacent column that said, well, if you slot things of a particular color into adjacent columns, it does this other thing. And so you get the right color, you slot it in that column, it triggers both of these things. Bonanza. And that's really cool. It just leans into Aquatica's strengths.
Unfortunately for me, it just made a game that is almost impossible to see what the other players are doing even that more difficult.
Oh, totally.
Like the cards that they're sliding up that you cannot, there's no way you can see the symbology from where you're sitting, and now you have these coral reefs that are another, you know, small print thing over only over there on their sheets that let them do all sorts of more game-breaking things that you cannot see. So it's impossible to understand what the other players are doing.
It is super heads down. That is absolutely true.
So whether you like that or not,
yeah,
then that'll be up to you.
And I'll absolutely agree that the text on the coral reefs is borderline illegible for most of the people sitting at the table. So the expansion, to its credit, includes a full new board. There's no add-on board that you need to worry about. It's an entire new board. It's double-sided, so you can play with both of the different kinds of victory conditions. There was a new kind of victory condition introduced in Cold Waters. I don't like it nearly as much as the default goals system. But anyway, tastes may vary. And there's no add-on board for the reefs. It's just printed right on the new board. That's great. It's wonderful. And still, I will note that even with both expansions, the game does fit in the base game box once you get rid of the insert. So don't need to worry too much about shelf space. But it is super difficult to read those reefs, even if you're the one person sitting at the right section of the board. Everybody else, illegible. Just way too difficult to read.
Yeah, the actual reef pieces themselves, I just don't get it. Like, that could have been one part that just did, you know, one step too far. It's like you had another thing you have to manage. And really
more
didn't,
combos, Walker!
And didn't really add anything.
It was, oh, you're such a spoiler. Okay, yeah, fair enough. Like, there's already lots of combo-tastic goodness in Aquatica, but I do like the new cards. There are new cards in both Cold Waters and Coral Reefs. There's some interesting effects with some of the new cards that trigger when they are on the top of your discard pile. So again, it encourages you to play your cards in a certain order, but it doesn't handcuff you in the process. Anyway, I like all the elements. I agree with you that at a certain point you might say enough is enough, but I just appreciate the fact that it continues to play to its strengths, introducing new stuff that is not particularly burdensome in terms of rules grit, but allows you new exploits to further, as you say, break the game. And Aquatica is reliably entertaining. I don't think that it's particularly rules dense. It's very approachable in terms of being able to play it even at a competent level. Yeah, you're probably going to get blown out by somebody who's played the game a whole bunch of times. So it's not a huge deal. Again, because it's so head down. And I just find it overall extraordinarily pleasing. It is one of the games that, as game daddy, I like to have in my rotation. I've talked about this before. Sometimes you're in a position where you know you're going to be playing with people who want to play a hobbyist game, but you don't know what their familiarity with complexity is, and you don't want to play the same light game over and over and over and over again. And so having enough of things like Aquatica, like Blue Lagoon, like a whole bunch of other really lightweight games, but nonetheless give you some of those same quality decisions that you're going to get in heavier experiences, I very much appreciate having.
And those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Need a little help? O'Reilly Auto Parts can help. Need advice? We've got advice. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Exceptional customer service. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
And we're back. Now we're going to do some news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, I love Risk 2210. It is impossible to get to the table because it has the word risk in the name. And you say risk to gamers, and you have to dodge punches. So
that's why it's called Risk.
I'm still going to buy this expansion. One, I'm curious.
It's a reprint, though, right? It's not an expansion?
No, well, it's sort of a reprint of expansion material that they gave out at tournaments.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it was never an official expansion. One, I'm interested to see if it will be even playable with the version that I have. I have like the OG Risk 2210, so I don't know if it's just going to match. Not to say that the new version, which I haven't even seen, is exactly the same. We're about to find out. And then I'm also wondering if I'm ever even going to get this to the table.
I'll play it with you.
We can hope. I love Risk 2210. There are leaders. Those who know Risk use your little D6s and you want to beat the roll of the other players. 2210, you get to roll a D8 if your leader's there. There's all sorts of fancy cards that you get to play. There's a moon that you can go up to. There's bases. There's mechs.
There's a moon. Yeah, I know there's a moon.
All sorts of fun stuff. And who knows what this expansion will hold. It is called Frontline Risk and is a collection originally released in 2004 that were available as tournament prizes.
Okay.
Mark.
Walker.
I know what people have said.
About you or in general?
We are so tired of playing diplomacy over and over again. We need a new diplomacy.
Okay.
Lots of people, you've heard people say that, right?
All the time. It's what all the kids are saying.
All the time. So now, obviously they've said that. Why else would they put out a new version of diplomacy? This is Diplomacy Era of Empire, another Renegade Games game. There's going to be one right after this in a moment. Another one of who asked for this? But anyway, looking forward to not purchasing Diplomacy Era of an Empire.
Is it the same game? Is it a redevelopment? Or
no, it's a totally different map with different sides.
Okay.
Different factions.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see you're as confused as I am. Next up from Renegade Studios in the same category of who asked for this, didn't want to play Axe and Allies in World War II? Didn't like the G.I. Joe version? Well, now you can play it under the sea, Mark. It is Battle for the Deep, powered by Axe and Allies. You can fight whales against starfish and mer people and yeah.
The undersea setting is always a strange move for me. I didn't understand, even in back in the days of XCOM. You remember when XCOM, brilliant PC game, oh, they're like, yes. Oh, for the sequel, we're just going to go underwater. It's like, okay. It just seems to be the natural next step for some people. I don't get it.
So if you really love Axe and Allies and you've played your version so many times that people are bored of it, now you have your undersea version.
Okay.
Or maybe, you know, you didn't like the World War II aesthetic. Now you've got a game. Mark, let's talk about the Bitewing Games crowdfunding project that has three Reiner Knizia games. One we've just talked about, Ego. And the other two that you'll talk about because you have more experience about them than I do. Except for one, Orbit. It's a new game.
Orbit is all new, yes. Silos is a redevelopment of Municipium, which was originally published by Valley Games in the aughts. And Municipium is not entirely unlike Beowulf, one of the lesser loved medium weight games designed by Reiner Knizia. The difference is that although both games have a vocal minority defending them, arguing that they are hidden gems, I am not one of the vocal minority that is willing to stand up for Municipium. But I'm very much in favor of the overall aesthetic vision of these three games. They have the same art style, and with the exception of the board for Orbit, I think a lot of it looks really great. And I appreciate that they're trying to come up with some sort of grand thematic cohesive vision for these products. And I'd happily try Silos. I'm always interested to see a system iterate on itself. And I'd try Orbit as well. So,
have they hinted around how much they redeveloped Municipium into Silos?
Tough to tell. My memory of the game system is not perfect. And I am much more conversant in the game systems of Beowulf the Legend. And so I'm very able to talk about the minute differences between Beowulf the Legend and Ego. But as far as Silos and Municipium, I'm less equipped.
Very colorful, that's for sure. On the subject of reprints, Mark, it seems as though Mission Red Planet is going to get a reprint every 10 years. Because that's what it has been. The first Mission Red Planet was 2005 by Asmodee. And then FFG put out a copy in 2015. And now Madagot is reprinting Mission Red Planet again in 2025.
Huh.
So if you like Mission Red Planet and haven't been able to get a copy, you're going to get another chance.
Another reminder that October 27th is Arkhipov Day, the day we celebrate the fact that Vasily Arkhipov in 1962 saved every human life on the planet in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis in an act of spectacular moral and physical courage. Arkhipov Day, October the 27th. That is the news, and why it doesn't matter, we now move on to our topic, which is expectations and crowdfunding, or as Walker would have it, the kids these days. Where do these kids get off?
Well, you know, there's this excess Kleenex that they want to use up, apparently, because of the tears, you see.
Explain the joke a little bit more. It might get it to funny.
Probably not.
Okay.
So anyway, crowdfunding promised, Mark. They promised we're going to bypass the publishers. We're going to bypass the local stores. We're going to bring you these games cheaper and faster.
Yeah. And you were going to get in on the ground floor, and it was going to be just this community participation thing. It was going to be like you were in there in the design
You're
studio.
You're going to help us.
Yes. It's a partnership.
Publish this game.
Partnership.
That would normally not get published.
Without your help, it's not going to happen.
We are a small indie company.
So, look, I was there during the early days of crowdfunding. My first crowdfunded project actually was BattleCon with Level 99. So I was there for the birth of a new publisher, right? And so now Level 99 is a very established publisher. It's not one of the biggest ones, obviously, but it is sufficiently established that they release things not on crowdfunding, as well as they have their crowdfunded lines. They've got a number of different lines of games. It was originally a one-man show. Brad Talton did everything. He was the designer. He did the promotions and the publisher, and now a lot of the stuff that Level 99 does is not designed by Brad Talton. So, you know, I've seen the life cycle of these things as represented in the life cycle of Level 99. I was one of those fools who pledged for the first printings of both Kingdom Death Monster and for Gloomhaven. And so I was there on the ground floor for a number of very, very successful Kickstarters. I have also been involved in Kickstarters that failed to fund. So I am in a... Sorry. I shouldn't even say failed to fund. Yes, I've been involved in Kickstarters that failed to fund. I've been involved in Kickstarters that's funded successfully and then produced nothing. So my money is gone.
I don't mind. You did crowdfund Scythe as well, I believe.
Yes.
I put that in the same category as those other two. I believe it was a fairly large, had influence in the market type game.
Yes, but it's a little bit different in that Stonemaier had already published things by that point.
True.
It was by no means their first project.
No.
But yeah. There have been a number of projects where it's like, yeah, I backed the first edition and they became big. Sure. By virtue of my participation, of course.
Well, obviously.
So look, here's one thing that I just want to state and I want to get your impression.
All right?
Because I can complain about the cynicism and I can complain about the marketing, about crowdfunding as much as everyone else, and I will later on. Here's where I think we're at. I think it is legitimate for the same platform to accommodate the people who we talk about sometimes on Pledge of Indifference, who are like, I am making this print and play game. it's me, just me, I'm doing this thing. Like, for example, Tiny Mini Golf, which actually turned out to be a really cool game. Very, very low scale, very lo-fi, very direct thing. But I think that it's okay if, so long as customers know what they're getting in for people like Queen Games or anybody else to show up and be like, this is just how we're going to be selling our next thing. And also all, our entire back catalog.
Oh yeah, I don't want to sound negative. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm against anything. This is all free market. Like, I have no problems with anything at all right now that's going on crowdfunding. No, they are not breaking any laws, and they are mostly upfront with everything they do.
Yeah, when it's upfront, that's the thing. Like, as somebody, I'm also a proponent of the free market, but a free market works when there are clear sets of understandings on both sides of the economic transaction.
And right? I feel as though the rules of the crowdfunding platforms, the rules in the background make it quite clear. The fact that the risk is 100% on the customer.
Sure. Yes, that part definitely.
There is no promise of anything. You are giving them money in the hopes that you will get a product in the future.
Yes. I do think that there's a certain amount of false consciousness or possible room for abuse in that the overall vibes that Kickstarter continues to send out, like the official position of Kickstarter, is that Kickstarter is not a store. It's totally a store. Like, yes. It's a store without the protections of a store, fine, right? But if you compare the overall gamut of things that exist on Kickstarter, I've got no problem with the different economic models that are contained on that same platform. I just wish there was a slightly higher degree of transparency. I wish there was a slightly higher degree of consumer awareness about what was going on. And I also don't like the fact that that ambiguity is often exploited even by above-board Kickstarters, right? When they want your money, it's a partnership, it's an investment. When they're not delivering, oh, well, you're a funder, you're an investor. When it's time to offer product, oh, this is all these toys that we will sell you like it's a store. And so the fact that they often exploit subtly or explicitly that ambiguity bothers me. But other than that, yeah, I'm mostly in the same.
Yeah, some of the exploit is the same thing I have the problem with is Unmatched, is that the consumer has...
Unmatched makes you so upset.
...has a FOMO mentality.
Sure.
Our hobby is filled with people that want and must have everything of a product they enjoy or are going to play.
Yes.
And these companies play into that by making some large parts of the game only available during the Kickstarter. And not only available during the Kickstarter, only available with the all-in pledge.
Okay. I don't think, Walker, you can in one breath say, I'm in favor of it because it's the free market, and then the next complain about FOMO, because the free market thrives to a large extent on exploitation of FOMO. I would also point out that between that model that you just described and the model that we used to live and die by in like about 25 years ago, where there was that one exclusive HeroScape miniature only being distributed in person at Gen Con or by scalpers after the fact, I will take the one on Kickstarter 10 times out of 10.
Oh, no, I can say, like I said, I hate that they do it. But I'm not complaining. You know what I mean?
Confused.
I'm allowing it. They can do as much as they want.
Okay.
Like, I can still hate it.
Sure.
I just don't hate it enough that I'm going to, you know,
complain about it. I think what you should be phrasing it as, they're allowed to do it and I will defend the right to do it. I just wish that those tactics were not commonplace.
Exactly.
Okay, that's fine. That, I think, is what could be, especially the way you deliver it, fairly parsed as a complaint in some contexts. So this is like what we talk about all the time in ethics and in government, right? Like, if you identify that an act is bad, it doesn't follow that it should be illegal, right? It's like, I think that thing is bad. I wish people didn't do it, but I defend the right to be able to do it. It's a very common stance, but you're allowed to complain about it.
And the thing of making it cheaper is that these Kickstarters usually lean towards things getting more expensive because the crowdfunding thing leans in more to deluxification.
Yes.
And more stuff. So the game, the promise of it being cheaper is quickly disappears into something being way more expensive.
We used to be able to save money as backers on Kickstarters because the first 5 years or so, it was not uncommon for it to be cheaper than the retail price and get free shipping. Now, I completely understand why free shipping went away. It was a nightmare. It destroyed a number of companies. I completely understand. Now, instead of bypassing the distributor and bypassing the middle person, we're just signing on to a different set of distributors and middle persons. So instead of Alliance Distributing, sometimes even it is Alliance Distributing, but instead of Alliance Distributing sometimes, it's instead one of the many fulfillment companies that effectively do the same thing, but on a parallel track. Can I talk about one thing, though, that I actually don't like about crowdfunding and that confuses me? This is one of those areas of transparency. The whole issue of what a funding goal is has largely become a lie. Sometimes it's true. Like, for example, Burned. Burned is going to be up on crowdfunding soon by Stone Circle Games. Going to be a backer again. I was a backer the first time. They didn't reach their crowdfunding goal, and so the project didn't fulfill. The thing that gets me confused is the increasing number of canceled projects where they're already fulfilled at like 150%, but they really wanted to be pledged at like 300 by the first day. And so they're going to take their ball and go home. What this means is that they're basically playing around with numbers.
Yeah, well, there's
in a way that I think
there's a whole math thing.
Hide the transparency. Yeah.
If you watch some, I've never watched them, but there are some crowdfunding videos out there where they talk about, you know, how much it makes in the first day or in the first hours, and then it projects forward.
And you need to be able to boast about the percentage value, right? You need to be able to say, funded in 5 minutes, and then you get to say in the splash page, like, 4,000% funded, like, because that gives the impression of value.
Yeah, there's that on top of that as well. Yes. And if you don't make a certain amount of money in the first few hours on the first day, you can project forward how much you're going to make on the whole project, and they just don't think that is the actual goal.
No, right. When it's the case that on the first day they cancel because, look, projections say that we're not going to make it, that's fine. It's the making it that I'm quibbling with.
Well, true, yeah.
I wish I knew what the making it was actually.
That's what I'm saying is that making it, I'm not referring to their pretend funding goal. I'm talking about what behind closed doors, what they actually thought they wanted to make.
Which highlights what crowdfunding really is. It is a vector for marketing, which, again, I say not as a slur. I mean, I've got problems with marketing in lots of contexts, but by and large, marketing is not a dirty word for me. I've spoken to a lot of different publishers I've spoken to several publishers who talk about how, I don't need the capital. I started out needing the capital. That was my first, say, 2 or 3 Kickstarter campaigns. Now I don't need the capital for more campaigns, but this is the best vector for cheap and or free marketing that exists in the hobby space, and that's why I keep doing crowdfunding. And so I just wish that more people approached it in that way. Like, again, more transparency is always for the good in a free market situation. And so the fact that language of, like, investment when it doesn't apply, it irks me a little.
It is really 100% pluses for people that put out board games. One, there is a plethora of content creators that make things that are coming out on crowdfunding platforms.
Oh, yeah. And that's their entire oeuvre. Yeah.
And so that's free advertising, free buzz, one when it's coming out, one when it, you know, when it is fulfilled, all sorts of times. One, you are putting all of your money, all of your upfront money is being given to you.
Yep.
It's not yours.
And you're offloading the financial risk. You're getting interest-free loans from people.
Exactly. Yeah. And then anyway, it's all just bonus for the people that are putting out games.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why some people cease doing it, like Jamie Stegmaier, from Stonemaier Games was very transparent about why he stopped using crowdfunding and he started doing other things. And I appreciate that. Transparency is always for the good. And Jamie, I feel, has always been really good about that. We're not on first name basis. Mr. Stonemaier.
And then, like I said at the beginning, and on top of that, you are getting, I don't want to say 100% of the profits, but such a huge margin, more than you would normally, because usually it goes
I'm not sure that's true.
It is. Usually it goes to the distributor, and the distributor takes a first cut.
I understand.
And then it goes to the local retailer, who also needs a big cut. So,
sure.
And then the amount that comes all the way back to the person.
I don't know how retail works. That's a gross exaggeration. I don't know how retail works. I have an understanding about how people take a chunk of this, a chunk of that. The problem is that a lot of these publishers, even the ones that are not like, this is my first design, try to help me get this thing off the ground. The majors don't really suffer from this too much anymore, but the wrong supply shock happens at the wrong time and or the market shifts in just a couple months, and now suddenly these fulfillment companies are charging 2, 3, 4 times what you expected, and now you've got storage costs as well, right? Because when you deal with major distribution, you don't have to worry about warehousing all through the steps of distribution. But when you're kickstarting something, suddenly all the risks are being reallocated. Often it's to your benefit, but sometimes it means you got to take a mortgage on your house just so you can ship something to Brazil.
Yeah, that's the, I'm going to get into that exact thing later on. I'm sure we both have some things people have complained about. And that one was someone had said, well, why can't I just buy this off you after the fact? And that, like you said, these people don't want stock.
Yeah.
They don't have places to hold this.
They don't want to maintain inventory and set up a web front and deal with it. Yeah.
And shipping and make a whole mail room where they're going to start shipping stuff out to people. No.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I do want to go back a little bit to what you said before about all the content creation that is focused almost exclusively on crowdfunding. And look, we're not interested in that either. We have a Patreon exclusive show that is only about crowdfunding. So there's that. But I will say that one consequence of the Kickstarter ecosystem that I very, very much regret as a hobbyist and as somebody who both produces and consumes board game media is that there is a certain segment of board game media that I think is vastly too influential and is not sufficiently transparent, which is pay to play. These are the people who are producing advertising for Kickstarter campaigns. Again, I've got no problem with marketing when it's transparently marketing. You know those inserts in newspapers that are ads, but they're designed to look like the rest of the newspaper? I hate that stuff too, and I think that newspapers should exercise stronger editorial control about crap like that. Similarly, I hate the fact that every time there's a new buzzy Kickstarter, there's like 8 video links. 3 or 4 of them are from people that maybe this is their second or third video. Maybe you'll see them next week. Maybe you won't. There are all these people constantly popping up. I don't know how much it costs to get that kind of promotion. Sometimes it's free. Sometimes they're paid. Sometimes it's not. But the standards of disclosure are really slipshod. So you can't know whether you're watching a paid advertorial or genuine editorial content. And I'm sorry, I realize this may be alienating some people. I also object to the fact that there are a lot of people who do both, who do the paid advertorial content as well as do editorial content that is not paid and try to issue their reviews on other projects. I think that's an unfortunate part of the media ecosystem. And frankly, it didn't exist at this scale prior to crowdfunding. On top of that, there are all these, you know, one of the expectations that people have when they go to a Kickstarter is that there's going to be like 6 to 8 videos of a variety of people. Some proportion of those videos are going to be learn to play videos. Again, I don't consume those. That's not really my bag. Or watching people play the game. Again, not my bag. In part because I find a lot of them of vanishingly small usefulness. Like Rotto, when Rotto is playing a game, he talks through everything he's doing. And I get a decent sense of what the game looks like when I watch Rotto play through a game. I don't like everything he does, but he definitely makes content that gives you a sense of how the game feels, right? And he's also very transparent about his biases, which I appreciate. A lot of these other playthroughs, they're just, hyping up the components and moving stuff around and getting rules wrong and all manner of other things. It's of questionable value. And again, I feel like before crowdfunding, it wasn't this bloated. Well, what am I to say? I started a podcast after the age of crowdfunding started, so that's right. I'm a massive hypocrite.
How dare you?
Yeah.
All right. Some complaints people have had. Too many updates. All these updates.
Not enough updates.
You think not enough updates? Oh, yeah. They complain.
Yeah.
And the updates, like the game has fulfilled 3, actually fulfilled, no problem with the project went fine. You got your product. It was great. You played. It was great. 3 years later, you start getting updates again because
you're on a mailing list now.
Because their friend is doing a Kickstarter or they're doing another crowdfunding.
Absolutely.
Thing.
So anyway. I pay zero attention to updates after the campaign is done. Sometimes I pay attention to crowdfunding because I'm like, ooh, new stretch goal. I'm not blind to the appeal of free stuff and new toys. I'm not immune to those charms. But once they've taken my money and now the long wait begins, I don't want to follow the series of overly optimistic projections, maybe sometimes even outright lies about when I'm going to get the thing. I try to forget about it and it's going to show up when it shows up. This is one of the reasons why people all the time, Huey all the time, and other people, like, oh, what's the next thing coming out that you're really excited about? I try to maintain a state of blissful, baby-like innocence, where things just show up magically, and then I get to play with them.
Yeah, I hype myself up and pretend like to be excited. Oh, you got this yet? Any shipping notice yet? I'm not actually excited. I don't get excited until I actually see the game in front of me. Anyway, that was the next complaint, is the fact that there's never an actual shipping date. You know, things start showing up when, you know, without any warning whatsoever. But the same people that were complaining about this said they just turn off the updates because they're sick of getting so many emails. Well, you know, those updates tell you that it's starting to ship. So maybe. And then I found out, I even researched because someone said something else about it. And I wanted to look into it to make sure it's true. And it is true. FedEx, UPS, Canpar, all of these places, Canadian Postal Service, maybe the US. I didn't look into the US one. You can log in. You can make an account on all of these platforms.
And get notified every time a shipment is made to your address. Yeah.
And you will get a notification. So even on these projects that don't give you a heads up, you can sign up to these free, non-intrusive, I feel.
Broadly, most, yeah, broadly, I agree.
That will give you immediate notification when something's being shipped.
Much less burdensome than crowdfunding updates, that's for sure. I will say that I have a tremendous amount of sympathy as somebody who was of no fixed address at several points in my life, that it can be very difficult to try to figure out what shipping address to use to manage shipping updates. And so you have to remain subscribed to all these updates because you need to tell them where to send the darn thing. In point of fact, Walker, we'll see what it is when it shows up. But just today, as I was telling you, I got a shipment notification for something that I thought was going to arrive in 2020. And so they have your mailing address because that's the year that I was basically being tortured unto insanity while being on the road. So stuff like that, you got to keep on track on. And if you're not, if you move around, you could be a seasonal worker. You could be somebody who gets moved around a lot for work. You could just be somebody who rents and moves around a lot because of the exigencies of the rental market. We're fortunate. We've got our fixed addresses. We're fine. But yeah, so managing all the updates is definitely a thing.
So in the end, I have no problems with crowdfunding.
That's not true, Walker.
No, I mean in the case that I don't have any like outright personal. Sorry, there's some practices that they employ against people that I don't agree with.
Sure.
But for me personally,
okay,
I understand that when I purchase a Kickstarter, that money is no longer mine.
And goes away in a magical way.
There is a chance that I will not see anything for it. And that is what I agreed to when I did it. It says right on the crowdfunding platforms that this is a promise of maybe getting something.
Somewhat akin to the cosmological idea of limbo, there's a magical realm into which your money disappears, and sometimes it disgorges games at an irregular interval. And we just have to accept that.
And I don't have a lot of experience with crowdfunding projects other than board games. I have done some, but not enough to have any sort of opinion. And I really feel as though, in general, we are very lucky. There have been some huge misplays, but if you really track sheer number of board games that go through crowdfunding,
excellent point.
They typically fulfill
the success rate.
Yes,
the rate of actually getting something for your money is vastly better than a lot of other endeavors on crowdfunding. That is absolutely true.
And on that same note, the publishers of these games, I feel, genuinely want to succeed and get you that product as quickly as possible.
I think that may be true universally, though.
Yeah. Well, we have seen some projects where greed definitely takes the front seat.
I am not necessarily willing to accept that it is necessarily mendacity or greed that causes those other projects to fail. I don't know.
So a lot of times when they ask for more money for shipping, or you see that the game is available on retail before yours comes, I immediately understand that they have issues. Mm-hmm. They put the game on retail so they can generate some money so they can ship the rest of the games to the backers. They're not doing that for malicious reasons all the time.
Right. And on that note, thank you so much for joining us. Just So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to have to spend some valuable time with us talk nonsense, speaking gibberish to gibbons. We hope to see you again soon. Please take care of yourselves and take care of your hobby.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.